May it please the court, my name is Ramon Pizarro. I attorney registration number 21400. I represent the appellants Tory Holdings and Daniel Thornton. In reviewing all of these, what was discussed in the briefs, I've thought about what really is at the bottom, or the most important aspect of this case, and that would be the jurisdictional issue, as I see it, and that is because no matter what happens, whether the court's interpretation of the contract and whether rescission was available, that is all of no meaning if the court did not have jurisdiction to entertain that case in the first place.
Mr. Pizarro, what substantive issue of patent law had to be determined in order to make the conclusion about contract law here?
And that the court made it very clear, at least I see it as being clear, that what it interpreted was, what was the invention? What was the thing that the parties embarked on to make? What was the really at the core of this agreement? And so the court found, and it is that was correct, that the agreement embeds in it the patent application for the definition of what the chore at hand was. And that, and then it had to go into the patent application to interpret what the invention was. And based on that, then it could go on forward to see, well, did the parties provide what was needed to build that, to make that? It's almost like the blueprint of a house was referred to in the agreement, and therefore the court had to read the blueprint. Had the contract been written in a different manner, had the contract said, we're going to do these things, we're going to make X at a certain date, you're going to provide X amount of money at a certain date, that then there would have been no need to go into what the patent application said and what was the invention that was claimed in the patent application. Therefore, that was a critical element, substantive element, that the court had to go into, and it did go into in its decision as to whether there was a mutual mistake that the parties attached different meanings to what was the subject matter of the agreement.
Mr. Pizarro, was the nature of the funding that was at issue, was that dependent on whether this device was in fact the one identified in the patent or some other device?
The nature of the funding?
Right, because whatever the device identified for, whether it was or was not the one covered by the patent, it seems like the source of disagreement was on the type of funding that would be provided.
As I see it, I think that the, or at least my understanding of what the plaintiff wanted was funding when he wanted it. And it was not really tied to where it came from, whether they had to use a line of credit or whether they dug into their pockets to get the funding, it didn't matter. But he wanted what he thought was his invention, manufactured and marketed according to the timelines that he had envisioned, and he wanted to see that the funding for what he had envisioned would be made. And what he envisioned was, of course, defined by the patent application. He wanted to see that funding put out from whatever source.
But I guess that the crux of my question is, the court did identify the device as the one covered by the patent, but was that necessary to resolve the basic dispute, which was had to do with the funding, the timing of it, or where it came from, that sort of thing?
It was necessary to interpret the patent application to decide what the device was. It was not necessary to decide whether the fund, where the funding came from. It was also necessary to decide whether the parties were going to raise funding together, or whether it was going to come exclusively from the appellants, from whatever source that was. So the patent issue was a necessary and actually disputed issue as to what the task at hand was, which in turn led into, once you know what you need to do, then that also defines, well, we need X amount of money, and then the third step would be, well, where is that money coming from? And so the whether the money was to come exclusively from appellants or not, that was way down the road. And the opinion, the trial court's opinion, clearly starts out that way and interprets the patent application and interprets it that it was not correct for the appellants to go forward on with a business plan of developing a device that did not have an antimicrobial component to it. My reading of that is that the court's interpretation of the patent was that the invention was not something that had an antimicrobial in it. The invention was something that had an antimicrobial in it. Therefore, going into something that did not have the antimicrobial in it was not what was agreed to. So,
point out in the court's findings that conclusion where he refers to this distinction that you're making.
Yes. I need to pull that up. I believe that is on page 5 of the court's decision. It says the court finds that the device covered by the agreement is one that contains an antimicrobial compound. What leads up to that paragraph starts in at the bottom of page 4. The court that in order to resolve the issue of timing and amount of funding, the court must address the parties' dispute as to whether the device covered by the agreement contained an antimicrobial compound, and that is that whether it does or does not was ascertained by looking at the provisional patent application that was filed, and the court says that the device set forth in there what was one that included a antimicrobial device.
What would the result have been if he found it was the other device? How would the result have differed in the interpretation of the contract?
Well, there would have been no cause of action for Mr. Haugen, because in these findings of fact, also the court did find that Torrey had produced and started to market a test device without an antimicrobial device, and that was not good enough. Because according to the court, what the agreement had to do or required was that the invention, which as the court interpreted the patent application, found was a device that had an antimicrobial component.
I don't understand what Haugen would have been asking Torrey to do if in fact it hadn't dealt with this other device. I don't see any logic in him conveying his patent to a company and then the contract doesn't have anything to do with his patent. I'm not following this at all.
Okay, so let me see if I understand the question. Torrey actually made the device after entering into the agreement. The device without the antimicrobial component, and that was going to be the as far as the marketing plan that Torrey had put together. That was going to be as an entry product, which would raise capital and raise awareness about the business, and then with capital raised through that, then the antimicrobial device would be developed and marketed. And so I guess so the question is, I don't understand the question beyond that.
It doesn't seem to me that either party got anything out of the agreement if what you're saying is true, because Torrey's not going to develop the antimicrobial device, and Hagen doesn't have any interest in a device that has no antimicrobial element. So they're completely, if those are the two interpretations, they have no agreement. They're not even talking about the same subject matter.
Well, excuse me, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, that's fine, Counsel.
The reason is that Torrey was doing this and earmarking those the reason it was going into the first device and earmarking all of that funding towards the development of the antimicrobial device. And that is an undertaking that we would not have undertaken if it was not, did not have this agreement in place. So Torrey got something, and Haugen got something because he got the commitment to invest the money, and it has had a mechanism whereby the resources to develop the antimicrobial version was raised. And also, I mean, I'm getting close to the end of my time, but these, the point being that whether both parties were working in different directions as to the contract, as to giving an interpretation of the contract, well, I don't think that provides grounds for rescission anyway. That would mean just a played out breach of contract. One of the parties was wrong about how they were performing, and that would not provide a basis for rescission. Also, just 3 weeks ago, a few days ago, I was looking to see how other courts, other state courts, had dealt with similar issues, and I found that the Texas Supreme Court had gone through very much the very same analysis pertaining to jurisdiction that had to do with a legal malpractice case, which is also traditionally seen as a state law case, and I tried to find a citation for it, but this decision was handed down on December 16, 2011, and it's Minton versus Gunn, and it is the Texas Supreme Court, and that provides, as I see it, an excellent analysis of this play between state law and federal law. I do realize that in my briefs, I cited a lot of cases that had to do with the Federal Circuit, but those are all really interpreting Supreme Court decisions, which are binding on this court. And the two key cases are the Christensen v. Colt Industries and the Grable v. Daru, which is 545 U.S. 308. And those go out with a balancing test and as to whether something falls into state jurisdiction.
Mr. Pizarro, did you file a supplemental authority on Minton against Gunn with the court?
I just found that just a few days ago, and that was decided right before the Christmas holiday.
Did you provide a copy of this case to Mr. Cristiano?
I just found this actually like 2 days ago at the most. So I have not. To answer your question, I have not.
Well, Mr. Cristiano, if you take a look at this case and you feel necessary to respond in any respect to it, I'll give you a few days to
say that. I wonder if I should make an objection, but I think I understand the direction.
Take a look at it, and if you need to respond to it, then you can send a letter to each of the three of us, no longer than a page, responding substantively to the case.
And I'd like to, there's only a minute left, and unless there's any questions right now, I'd like to reserve that for a rebuttal.
All right, fine.
Thank you.
And Mr. Cristiano, we'd like to have that within 5 days.
Do we have what's the identification of the case?
It is Minton, M-I-N-T-O-N, the Gunn, G-U-N-N, and it is Texas Supreme Court case number 10-0141. Decided December 16, 2011.
Yes. Mr. Cristiano, now I'm referring to Mr. Cristiano.
I'm using the appellant, I guess. Maybe that's why you got confused. It is very good to see Judge Nieto up there, by the way. So you're the one in there. Weren't you the one in the Jefferson County District Court for you?
Yes.
Okay. Good to see you. My memory's better back then, so, but anyway, good to see you. All right, I'm ready to begin. Members of the, I guess what I'm hearing is that, well, surprisingly, they've abandoned their first argument, so I'm not going to spend any time on that, an oral argument. I'm having trouble with, I really am having trouble with this, that with all due respect to Mr. Pizarro, when you asked him to sort of clarify, you know, how, with regard to the second issue, any of the issues related to a determination of patent law, he was not able to come up with what I believe to be a rational argument that it was. The fact is that, and I'm sure you're aware of this, and I got a little extra time, so I'll spend maybe a couple minutes, but the contention of Mr. Haugen was that his idea for this IV securement device incorporated an antimicrobial component that wouldn't affect sort of the adhesiveness of the patch that he intended to put on people's arms to secure the IV. That was the sort of the unique nature of it. Because it incorporated an antimicrobial compound, it required FDA approval and an FDA sort of processing. And the expert testimony at the trial was that, you know, that sort of approval requires probably funding of about at least $250,000, I think, to the best of my recollection. So, you know, the reason I went to these people to join forces with them was because they indicated to me that they would have at least the seed capital so that I could, you know, develop the prototype that it would be attractive to potential third-party investors. And I could get we could proceed with the patent application. Once we got that interest, if we got some money from that, as well as beginning to, you know, the beginning stages of acquiring the FDA approval. What happened was there was this breakdown soon after the contract was signed, where the defendant here said, you know, we're not going to fund the money. We're not going to fund anything. We don't have the money to fund it. What we're going to do is we're going to get all the money from third-party financing. And Mr. Haugen said, you know, our agreement was, now you had the money, at least $100,000 or $150,000. I thought like $250,000. I think the judge says it was at least $100,000 they represented they had to get me in a position so that we could get third-party funding. That was the nature of the mutual mistake of fact that he based the rescission on. So everything, they're not attacking that. But it gets us to the point of this last contention they make, which is, you know, where they reference this, I guess it's Jim Arnold, case that says that, you know, where they contested the jurisdiction of the court to deal with that issue, and they made this argument, and the argument is just groundless. It's got nothing, you know, that portion of the dispute is determined entirely independent of patent law. And that is that, you know, the issue was, did this or did this not, did the product that Mr. Haugen wanted to market and create, sort of create and produce and market, incorporate an antimicrobial device? You don't have to look at the patent application to do that. That's a source of information, perhaps. But it wasn't even a contested issue at the end of the trial that, yeah, it incorporated an antimicrobial device. That's a contract issue that has to do with the party's intent. And therefore, once that was determined, then Judge Pratt, you know, basically supported the plaintiff with regard to the contention that it supports the notion that Mr. Haugen believed that he needed this seed money to proceed, and therefore there was a mutual mistake of fact, and therefore I'm going to rescind it, but it's got nothing to do with patent law. And
Judge Pratt has a footnote in his order that says the court need not look to parole evidence on this issue, meaning that the device covered by the agreement is one which contains an antimicrobial compound. And he goes on in the footnote to say, because this question can be answered within the four corners of the agreements,
right,
and including the provisional patent application, which was the subject of the assignment. So I don't think the judge thought it was a dispute of fact that this was the device that was the subject of the contract.
Okay. I don't think the defendants disputed that. So it was just almost a admitted fact that Judge Pratt found, even without reference to any parole evidence, and that was it. So once you get that, then you get into FDA approval and what the estimated cost of FDA approval was, and that supported his ultimate finding that Mr. Haugen reasonably believed that they were going to provide the funding, and therefore there was this mutual mistake of fact. And I think that's probably about all I've got. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to respond, but I think I've gone over everything, and that's it as far as I'm concerned.
Thank you, Mr. Cristiano.
Thank you.
Mr. Pizarro? You've got a minute.
Yes, thank you. The patent application discusses with antimicrobial composition and without antimicrobial composition. The claims actually, the one claim, I don't remember how many claims there are, but the claim in the patent actually does not include a microbial. The antimicrobial discussion is included in the body of the specification. The $100,000 amount that Mr. Cristiano talks about, that was not found. There's no specific amounts of money in the contract, anywhere in the contract or in the agreement, so I don't see how there can be a mistake about that. Tory and Mr. Thornton provided a mechanism to get this thing moving, and they provided the vision and the plan and started working towards that direction. Whether Mr. Haugen had a different idea as to how to do it, well, that's not in the agreement. He should have put it in the agreement if he wanted to do that. And that's all I have. Thank you,
Mr. Pizarro. Thank you, both gentlemen, for your arguments. The matter is deemed submitted, and you can expect a written opinion to issue in due course.